Most normal people have a hat stand or a table to put their letters. My parents have bags of basmati rice in case there is a famine in Birmingham. If there are ever floods in Birmingham, that house is going to fluff up and burst.
Today we're having a laugh with some very funny women. Stand-up comedian Shazia Mirza.
I just wanted chaos. I just thought this was so exciting and I knew I was at the centre of it.
Writer, comedian, co-founder of the Women's Equality Party and host of hugely popular BBC chat show QI, Sandy Toksvig.
My sister and I do this thing and it makes me laugh every single time. If I phone her when she answers the phone, I always go, "What?" She does it to me. And we do it every single time and it always makes both of us laugh.
Yes.
And she'll go, "You phoned me." And I go, "Oh, yes, sorry, my bad."
And last but not least, today's fantastic co-host, comedian and writer Sarah Pascoe. Oh, and an unexpected guest.
Sorry, the dog's having fun.
What's the dog called?
His name's Mouse.
I feel that Mouse is part of the podcast.
Yes.
I'm Polly Russell and I can't wait to get out the way and kick off this episode of Unfinished Business, a podcast from the British Library. Throughout this podcast series, I've been delving into subjects and themes that are explored in an exhibition at the British Library. The show's all about the history of women's rights, and so I've had some fascinating conversations about everything from cycling to domestic violence to beauty to pleasure. A theme that runs through the exhibition is voice and how women have been historically silenced. Also, a theme that's run through the exhibition is how women have refused to be silenced, how they have been loud, they have been funny, they have taken up space. Nevertheless, there have been attempts to silence them throughout time, whether we're talking about there being fewer female than male MPs in the UK, female writers throughout history having to adopt male pseudonyms to get published, or women who speak out online being trolled and abused, far more, it seems, than men. There is a clear trend. So today, I want to hear from some women who stand on stage and command attention. I want to know what challenges they face, how the comedy scene has changed over time, and what still needs to be done.
The live comedy scene is really improving. There are a lot more women in it and having a much better time, but it's still not perfect. Some people still feel unwelcome, and that needs to improve. My name is Sarah Pascoe, and I have Unfinished Business.
I am thrilled to be joined by Sarah Pascoe because she's not only a hilarious comic, having performed sold-out gigs and appeared on countless TV shows, but as a writer and a podcast host, she tackles the biggest issues head-on. Her first book, Animal, the Autobiography of a Female Body, looks at how the female body has been discussed, fetishized, and misunderstood throughout history. And her 2019 book and podcast series, Sex, Power, Money, explores sexual relations with a particular focus on male sexuality and on sex work. But let's take things back a bit. I was curious to find out when she realised she was funny.
As an experiment, I'd been in a sketch show, and one of the other people in the sketch show was a stand-up comedian, and I'd been to see him doing a gig. And rather than what I thought stand-up comedy was, which was, I thought people were improvising, I thought they were just geniuses and they spoke for 2 hours and they remembered what they said earlier and they could kind of refer back to it and everyone would clap. What this gig was 12 men, all of them quite skinny in anoraks, holding pads, talking about ideas. And that was suddenly very achievable for me. And then I wrote 5 minutes about how High School the Musical was unrealistic for young people. And I wrote a version of Secondary School the Musical about my school. And then that's what I did for my first set. And I got very drunk beforehand. I drank 2 large glasses of wine. And I kept thinking, I can't imagine doing it. Like, I can't imagine someone saying my name and me just walking on stage and doing it. And then, you know, suddenly it does happen. They say your name and you just walk up there and then it's kind of done. And so I didn't have a storming gig or anything, but when you do something that scares you, you get a lot of neurochemical rewards. And so afterwards, I walked out and I've never ever felt like this from anything ever again. But I literally felt like I was bulletproof. And I really did, was completely sure, oh, I found what I'm supposed to do. It's that.
And when you're there and it's going well and everyone is listening to you and you're holding them, does that feel like very powerful? Do you feel powerful in that moment?
I feel very lucky. And I think it really, for me, it really taps into when you're a toddler, like a 3 or 4 year old, and you walk into a room and everyone's like, oh my God, it's you. And you're like, yes, it's me. And that feels like such a special thing. Like being applauded when you turn up for work is crazy. Now imagine if you walked into an office at night and everyone's like, oh my God, yeah, Alan's here. Hello, Alan. Oh, hello, Massey. And Mouse thinks I'm clapping him. Are you a good boy? Are you a good boy? I don't ever really get used to that or take that for granted.
When we calmed down a bit, the conversation moved on to the inevitable. What's it like being a female comic in a very male-dominated scene?
Some people who might talk about sexism in comedy, as in, is it harder or are people less receptive to a woman? That's no different to a woman speaking in general. So I think you could align it with politicians, for instance. Do we have a strict idea of how a woman should behave, what she should talk about, how she should dress, how she should, her general deportment? And I think a lot of women in lots of spheres would say, oh, I've always got a thing in the back of my head. If I want to get ahead, I have to do certain things. And I think it's such a shame, and it obviously isn't just women, but that anyone has to have a framework in the back of their head about that limits their creativity or limits their anarchism, if you like. There's a really fantastic book by Virginie Despentes called The King Kong Theory. And she talks for a while in it about something that I think is so groundbreaking, which is about your right to be ugly as a woman. Because actually, she feels that ugliness and unattractiveness is the biggest kind of FU to the patriarchy. Because she says that there are spaces that women can take up, but only if you kind of toe the party line. And that includes, and it isn't about necessarily being beautiful, but looking like you've tried, as in you've groomed yourself, you're playing the game. And there was something I found so exciting about that, because it also really scared me. Like, what would happen if I turned up to a panel show, even a panel show like QI, which is hosted by Sandy, who we're going to be talking to, and I said, by the way, I haven't plucked my moustache, I'm not washing my hair, and I'm not putting on a flowery dress. I'm going to sit here in a white shirt like a man would. And I don't think I'd get rebooked.
Yeah, and it would take some gumption, wouldn't it? It would take some gumption, because we spend our lives putting on a particular sort of performance.
That's it, and we absorb it, and then we don't question it, because it's easy, isn't it? Or we tell ourselves, oh, I want to wash my hair or shave my armpits. And sometimes we genuinely do, but it's because very rarely do we actually get the opportunity to go, what do you want then?
As Sarah mentioned, next up, we're joined by a great of the comedy world, Sandy Toksvig. In case you haven't been on the planet Earth in the last 20 years and don't know anything about her, Sandy is a British-Danish writer, comedian and broadcaster. If that's not enough, she also was one of the founders of the Women's Equality Party, and she co-presented National Treasure of a show, The Great British Bake Off, from 2017 to 2020. So Sandy entered our video call and was met by Mouse.
For some reason, I thought it was a hand puppet and not a dog, and I thought we were doing a different kind of show entirely.
I realise that while I know you've been doing comedy a long time...
I'm terribly old, darling.
But so did you always want to be a comedian? Are you one of those people?
Oh, God almighty, I didn't even know it was a thing. And in fact, when people say that about me, I'm always slightly surprised, because they never think I say funny things. I just say what I think, and then oddly people laugh at it. So I wanted to be a human rights lawyer.
Did you?
Yeah, I trained as a lawyer at university. And I was in, there's a thing at Cambridge called the Footlights. I was in a thing called the Footlights. And I was in that, as well as doing my law degree. And a professional director saw me in it and said, would you like to come be in a show after university? And I thought, well, I'll have a gap year after university as well as before. What a marvellous thing. And I'm just having the longest gap year in history. But I had no intention of doing what I do. I'm always surprised when people write comedian. I've written, I don't know, 26 or 27 books now. And nobody ever puts author. And you think, how many are you supposed to write before before you get to be called an author.
Okay, well, we know that Polly from that interviewed me at the beginning is listening, so we'll make sure that we, on the podcast, it's Sadie Toksvig, author.
Author, broadcaster, which sounds very sensible.
So I wanted to ask you a question. At what point in your career did somebody first ask you about being a woman? And you know the kind of question I mean.
Constantly, darling. It just became sort of tiring after a while. I think the worst example of that was Have I Got News For You, which is 1990 it started. They did two pilots, one with me and one with Angus Dayton. And they said to me, completely straightforwardly, we much preferred yours, Sandy, but the BBC don't feel a woman can be in charge of making fun of the news. Mm. And I just took it. All right, that's 30 years ago.
It's a very interesting thing to, I think, focus upon for a second, is that people always assume sexism comes from an audience, and quite often it doesn't. It comes from the gatekeepers. It's something that still happens around panel shows, some particular panel shows, and the channel, I think, has tried to improve. They predict what an audience will and will not take or not enjoy, and it's based on their biases.
But it's absolute madness. I mean, we've increased on a show that I host called QI, we've increased the number of women participants enormously. And our viewing figures have gone up, so...
Yeah, they would tell you that your average person, they will not be able to listen to women talking. Like, they won't. And it was, you know, adult men saying that. It wasn't viewers at home saying, I'll throw my television out of the window if there's more than one.
No, or, you know, I don't know what the fear was, that our cycles would collide and we'd be unable to focus. Mm. I don't know what the problem was. But I've also heard, you know, that I'd be up for a job and they were looking sort of for five comedians, and then they'd go, oh, we've already got a woman. Oh, well done. Yes. So that's that box.
Well, it still happens. I mean, it still occasionally happens to women, but it also happens to gay people, and it's happening to people of colour all of the time.
Yeah, disabled people.
Yes.
We kid ourselves if we think we're done. I mean, apart from myself hosting QI, I'm trying to think of another woman who hosts a big primetime show. Yeah. And I'm going to tell you a secret, darling. It's not that difficult. It's because they tell you the answers beforehand. It's not.
Yes.
And the cards with the questions on, they're not as heavy as I was led to believe. So,
and you get a cushion on your chair, Sandy.
I have a cushion on my chair. Yeah. Well, the first 3 years, I had Stephen's chair because they didn't want to invest in a whole chair for me. And it was this completely wrong size for me. I had to climb up on a little box to get onto the chair. And I now, and I think this is a sign that I've arrived 5 years in, I have my own chair. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that is. They've decided you can stay. Okay, let's invest in a chair.
Let's get the woman a chair.
So in terms of that, in terms of being asked questions about being a woman in comedy, something that I have really struggled with is that the person asking the question, I often find that they're being quite rude, but as if it's on behalf of somebody else. A journalist in Edinburgh for a major newspaper, a proper newspaper, you'd think, will then say, what do you say to people who say you can't do your job because you're a woman? And then you think, well, excuse me, who are those people? Is that you? Do you think I can't do my job?
Who's been shouting at you? Yes, I know. I mean, it happens all the time, and you'd think it would go away. You know, what do you say to people who say women can't be funny? I don't know what to say apart from stand up. The test that I always suggest is go to any public function and spend a short time standing outside the gents as the door opens and closes, and all you'll hear is the sound of running water. Stand outside the ladies as the door opens and closes, and you will hear laughter.
Yeah, guffaws of laughter. That's true.
Women just find life naturally funny.
Yeah, I think it's really good that you even have an answer. Lots of people that I know, including myself, we say that we won't answer the question, because after you've answered the question earnestly a couple of times and not been funny, it feels almost like you're working against yourself, that every interview you're reinforcing a stereotype you don't agree with. And my entire job and the fact that I've bought a flat disproves. Like, and all of my colleagues are women who are flourishing. So I'm the worst person to ask about this. Go and ask somebody who thinks that.
But women doing comedy isn't, of course, a new thing. Women have always been funny and they've always been entertaining, despite some bad PR.
I'm the Idol of the Girl, sung by Miss Vesta Tilley, Edison Records.
Indeed, in the exhibition, we feature a woman called Vesta Tilley, who was incredibly famous in the early 20th century as a music hall artist known for dressing up as a man.
There's no resisting me when I'm above. In my dress I study, detail everything.
Sandy too celebrates female comics of the past.
Mustn't forget about people like Jane Foole, who was an English court jester, certainly the jester to Catherine Parr and Mary I, and possibly also to Anne Boleyn. We're talking about the middle part of the 16th century. It is not a new thing, women making people laugh. And certainly I rather imagine around the fire in the cave, women were crying with laughter. I mean, one of the things we now know, we look at a lot of the art, for example, of the cave paintings, and we look at the handprints and so on. And the new theory is a lot of it was done by women, and the presumption was that cavemen came back from a bit of bison hunting and had plenty of time to do art. Yes. And probably it was women, actually, because who else has got the time? And it's one of the things that changed my life. I also studied anthropology at university, and there was a wonderful woman called Dr. Deborah Swallow. I think she then ran the Courtauld Institute, and she talked to us about the Ashango bone. Do you know about the Ashango bone?
No.
So the Ashango bone, it's from Upper Paleolithic, and it's got markings on it. It's a tally stick. And so this was, lots of people said, this is a man's first attempt at a lunar calendar. Mm. And she said, what man in the world would have wanted to mark out a lunar calendar? Surely this is woman's first attempt at a lunar calendar. But of course, the presumption has been that man somehow wanted to control the thing, and it's clearly a woman trying to sort out her cycles. She's clearly going, scratch, scratch, scratch. Oh, it'll be tomorrow, you know, because she's running around and she's trying to look after the children, she's got stuff to do. But it totally changed my life in terms of questioning the answers that you've been given, particularly in relation to gender and how we treat each other.
Sandy is passionate about drawing attention to women and their achievements that have been overlooked throughout history. Her recently published book, Toxvig's Almanac 2021, An Eclectic Meander Through the Historical Year, features fascinating figures from history, such as revolutionary women, to serial killers, pirate nuns, to pioneering civil rights activists, doctors, to dancing girls. Sarah's a big fan.
It's so much fun to read. I'm imagining you sitting there in your house with a smile on your face and an encyclopedia open.
Well, the thing is that I needed a minimum of 365 women, and the heartbreaking bit about this book is the women I left out. So, in a way, it's scratching the surface. So, for example, there's an incredible Japanese suffragette called Kamuko Kimaro. And I think many people will not have heard of her. She was astonishing, and she went to America, and we are talking about the early part of the 20th century. She went to the United States and marched with the suffragettes there and learnt from them. And I think we forget, when we look at the history of people battling for women's rights, we forget how worldwide it was. And what I hope is that you might read about Kamuko and then go and look her up, because I couldn't possibly do justice to her story in the little entry that I put in about her. I think one of the more shocking ones is Donna Strickland. So Donna Strickland's a phenomenal Canadian physicist, and people kept trying to put up a page on Wikipedia about her and kept being told she wasn't notable enough. And this is a real issue. And do you know what day her page went up? The day she won the Nobel Prize.
Oh, my God.
So that's what it takes. That's what it takes. Yeah. So it doesn't really matter if it's sport or physics or whatever the thing is. There's a story where you just go, that's extraordinary.
People want to hear that things are getting better for women in comedy. They want to hear that there's a narrative of it's much easier now, or there are, if there were sexisms 15 years ago in the clubs, they're not there anymore. The reason I feel wary of that question is it's really dangerous to ask the victors, oh, is the world fair? Because they will tell you it is.
It so isn't, darling. And I still meet young female comics who are really struggling and struggling to get proper representation and struggling to... What seems so ridiculous now is when the Comedy Store started, so I was there on the very first night in 1980, I think it was. I performed, and it used to be in Leicester Square, and it wasn't possible to go to the loo during the show, because it was, you had to go through the audience to get to the loo. So there was a basin in the corner, and it was thought to be fine because the boys all just weed in the basin. Well, obviously, that was tricky, and I'm not exaggerating. Josie Lawrence, with whom I was in the Comedy Store Players for many, many years, she used to have to lift me up to wee in the sink. And it's how many women are going to put up with that stuff?
Yeah.
In order to carry on with it. Nobody thought anything of it. It was fine for the boys. It's not okay. Yeah.
Well, in the whole of London, until there were Lion's Tea Houses, there was nowhere that women could go to the toilet. The reason that women went to visit each other was that then they could, if they could have a cup of tea, because there would be a bathroom they could use.
Okay, so during lockdown, my wife and I had what we called bladder limits. So we would go bicycling, but we had to come back at least within a 2-hour window, because that was my bladder limit. And I went out and I bought, right? This is a thing you can buy. It's a pop-up toilet tent. And it's about the size, when it pops up, it's about the size of a telephone booth, and then a collapsible toilet. And we carried this in the boot of the car and have put it up on a lay-by and gone in, had a wee into a plastic bag, and then taken it away, a bag full of wee in the back of the car. It is a serious issue. Women being able to go to the toilet is a serious issue.
Well, it's a serious issue, and it connects actually very well to period poverty, which is something that we know that with people we're talking about a lot more now. But for years, no one talked about that girls all over the world, including our country, don't go to school when they're menstruating because they'll bleed through their uniform or onto chairs, or because they simply, it's expensive, because our country also at that time also had that the VAT, the tax as luxury items, but also that period products are so expensive, even though, again, it happens to half of people.
Well, I'll give you an idea of a joke that I got into terrible trouble for. I was once doing a Time Team, which was a Channel 4 archaeological programme, and it was live. I'm at some midden, some ancient rubbish heap in York, and the very solemn archaeologist takes out this large piece of moss and says, this would have been used by women for their monthlies, this is, you know, and then thrown away. And I said, oh, Tudor period. And I thought it was quite funny.
Yes, very funny.
I got into terrible trouble. The producer was furious. They didn't want me to be in any more scenes. They how dare you? And don't you know it's live television? And I thought, oh my God, all I said was Tudor period.
That's not a rude term for your menses, yeah.
I was shunned at lunch. Shunned.
Oh, wow. I think it's so important anything that makes people feel unnecessary shame to be talked about. And so the effect, not only that you can't say the word period, as part of a kind of flippant joke, you won't go, okay, let me talk to you about clotting. You weren't trying to put anyone off their sandwiches. You were just using the word period. I'm glad that you said it. I'm glad that someone was there to say it. And I'm glad now, because lots of period adverts now don't have the little blue liquid anymore. There are companies now who actually use red liquid and actually demonstrate what their product does, and all of those kind of things are better.
Yeah, I didn't know it was supposed to be red. Mine is blue, and that was very worrying.
Oh, okay. It must be like a Danish thing.
It's a Danish thing, Lee.
Yeah, it's a Danish thing.
It's all very clean.
It's just different. It's just because our society is happier. We don't need to bleed red, sorry. One of the things that's brilliant about having someone like you be very funny alongside important activism and political work is that being humourless has often been weaponized against women who try to do anything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the doer feminist who hasn't shaved her legs and has an uncontrollable bush, that kind of thing. And I just think that's just a way of having another go, isn't it? That's just that that somehow we're just being grumpy about the crazy idea that we'd like the same pay. This is madness.
So in terms of the future, our conversation, as short as it was, I think we have reflected how much unfinished business there is. For anybody listening, especially if they're interested in comedy, what should we be doing?
Well, I mean, there's just so much to be done. And my biggest concern is that COVID is definitely going to have an disproportionate impact on women. More women do the care in this country, around the world. In fact, more women do unpaid work, more women work in the informal market. Obviously, I'm going to tell you that I'd like everybody, boys and girls, because equality is better for everybody. It isn't a thing where it's just better for women. It's better for my son as well as for my daughters. I'd like everybody to join the Women's Equality Party. In a sort of strange way, it's a non-political party. I don't care if you're from the left or from the right or whatever. Join us, because there's going to be so much work to be done. But then, rather than being inactive and thinking, oh no, it's all terrible, you know, I co-founded a political party with Catherine Mayer, and we're busy doing. We had an extremely successful general election. We could only afford to stand five candidates. We stood against five men, all of whom had outstanding allegations of sexual harassment or impropriety. And four of them stood down and one of them lost his seat. Those five men are no longer in Parliament. So please know that even if it's a quiet thing, that's a triumph. So, of course, what I would say is we can all do something. Go to the exhibition and be fired up. Extend your knowledge and realise how astonishing and wonderful the contribution of women is to the world.
Hey, that's so perfect, because what you've just put so succinctly is that being funny doesn't mean that we're never serious, and being serious things needing to happen and serious things that happen in the world doesn't mean we never laugh. So that's a perfect place to leave it.
That's why I love you so much. I think you're so bloody brilliant. You just nailed both sides of things. I think you're terrific.
Well, I think you're terrific. And I think that then anyone listening, they're perfect things. Join the Women's Equality Party. Go to the exhibition when you can go to exhibitions again. And also enjoy your book. I'm holding it up to you, even though you know what it looks like. Toxfix Almanac. Make sure you buy that. Thank you so much, Sandy.
Right, I've got to join the love in too, because I adore Sarah and Sandy, and I adore them because not only are they hilariously funny and entertaining, you know, my cheeks are actually aching from laughing, but I also adore them because they are also serious. Sarah's books, her podcasts, her series, they deal with really important issues. Sandy, one of the funniest women alive, she set up a political party. That's very serious. It was fantastic to hear them in conversation. After Sandy left the call, I asked Sarah how she felt about their chat.
What I really loved that kept being reinforced was that individuals are so powerful, and we're often made to feel very powerless. And actually, that really does link in with talking about women who want to represent themselves in male-dominated fields, is that the reason that you think, oh, I shouldn't be there, it's mostly men, is the reason you have to be there. It's why it's so important, whether that's comedy or anything else.
And this rings especially true for our next guest, Shazia Mirza. Shazia is an award-winning stand-up comedian and a writer from Birmingham.
The thing is, white men think they're the masters of the universe. And all of a sudden, all their rights have been taken away by gay people, black people, Muslims, women, Jews, immigrants. You know what I do now? I get on the bus and I go, "Oi, Dave, get out of that seat. Move to the back of the bus. Rosa's back."
The last time I gigged with Shazia was in Edinburgh, and it was a gig where I was hosting and lots of acts were doing 5 minutes, and the gig had been so hard. No one had done very well, including myself. And then Shazia came at the end and was absolutely just so phenomenally brilliant and funny. And I was watching her from backstage going, okay, that's how you do it. So I think of Shazia as such a, not that she's old, but like an elder statesman of comedy. She's done everything. She's done all of the hard gigs. And so I'm really interested to hear about her journey into comedy and what she thinks about it now, and if she's happy with what she's doing. Hello, mate. Hello.
Hi.
So, Shazia, do you come from a funny family? Did you have lots of laughs growing up?
No. My parents are not funny people at all. But there was a lot of comedy in the house. We were always watching sitcoms. Like, there was always Are You Being Served, The Two Ronnies, The Liver Birds, but there were not funny people in the house.
And does that include you? I mean, were you funny at school?
I mean, I wasn't funny. I was an attention seeker. I was always doing naughty things. I'd ask the teacher if I could go to the toilet 10 minutes before the end of the lesson, and then I'd go and hide everybody's coat. I'd go and hide them in the toilet, or I'd hide them behind the tennis courts. And then when the bell would go, everybody would be screaming for their coat. There'd be all these kids crying, going to the school gates. And it was me causing chaos. I just wanted chaos. I just thought this was so exciting and I knew I was at the centre of it.
That comfortableness or the seeking of like being the centre of attention, was there a natural segue for you from that into performing?
No, there was no way that somebody like me in my situation and my background was ever going to be a stand-up comedian. You know, the people I saw doing comedy were white men. And I never knew what a stand-up comedian was. I'd never been to a comedy club in my life till I started stand-up.
Yeah. So what was the journey into stand-up then? Because that's fascinating as a starting point of thinking, oh, that's something that white men do.
I just thought, I loved comedy, I love writing. I'll just go and do a comedy course about how to write comedy. And on the course, one of the first things the teacher said was, I want you to write some material that's personal, that's truthful. So I wrote some material about how I hated having a moustache. I've tried to shave it, pluck it, everything. I bleached it, it's gone blonde. And that's how it started. I stood up in front of the class, I said the stuff, and everybody started laughing. And the teacher said, you need to go out on the comedy circuit and perform this. And I just thought, no way, I'm not doing that. But that was the beginning of it. When I was growing up as a girl, I never had a voice. I have three brothers.
Yeah.
And I was always told as a girl, as a woman, you should not speak up in front of a room full of people because you'll never get married. Nobody will want to marry you. No man wants a woman who's outspoken and loud.
Yeah.
And actually, I've found that now to be true. My mother was right, actually. She didn't always talk shit, but actually she was right. I always used to also, when I started comedy, I used to have a lot of people email me, say, this is not the right thing for a Muslim woman to be doing. It's comedy. This is not the thing for you.
Yes.
So it kind of reinforced what I'd grown up with. And so I always felt a bit, not guilty, but I felt, you know, maybe I'm not doing the right thing.
That must have been so hard because you've got that coming in two directions, it sounds like. Your gigs are going great, but you've got this from childhood message that women aren't supposed to be the centre of attention. And then I can't believe that people would message someone they don't know and say, because you're Muslim, you shouldn't be doing this. That must have been such a heavy thing for you to bear, even if you disagreed.
Well, I had a lot worse than that. I mean, I used to get death threats. I used to get hate mail. I used to get a lot, and it wasn't because of the comedy, because a lot of these people had never watched my comedy or they'd never seen comedy in itself. They just saw me on stage and said, that is wrong. This is not the place for a woman.
Right.
And actually, people used to stop my parents in the street in Birmingham and say, we've seen your daughter on TV doing comedy. And my mum and dad were so embarrassed, they'd say, oh, no, it's just a hobby. She's going to give it up soon. You know, she has a degree in biochemistry, you know.
So it sounds like it was quite difficult for your parents. Were they supportive of you and what you were doing? Did they understand why you wanted to do comedy?
No, they didn't. My parents have never seen me perform, ever. You know, they're from a different generation. They're from a different culture. They're from a different background. And they didn't know anybody that was a stand-up comedian. But then neither did I.
Can I ask about the effect? I think most people can't imagine what it would be like to get a death threat because of their job or for being in the public eye. Did it ever make you think about quitting, or did it make you want to hide away and be less exposed?
I just couldn't understand it. And I was thinking about this the other day that, you know, I got hate mail, I got death threats. God, I must really love comedy. I must really love this to have carried on. What was I thinking? People wanted to kill me and I said, no, that's all right, that's all right. I'll go on stage tomorrow night and do the same again.
Because there was nobody like you doing comedy, at the same time as some people were like outraged, unreasonably so, you are probably a much bigger influence than you realise in when people, especially women or women of colour, see people who are like them on stage being brilliant. For them, they haven't just seen white men doing it. They do go, oh, I can do that too.
I think that's true, is that in order to be what you want to be, sometimes you have to see it first. I mean, when I was growing up, my dad always used to say, hurry up, get downstairs. Trevor is on the TV. Because Trevor MacDonald was the closest thing to an Asian woman at the time. And we used to go, but Daddy's black. Yes, but this is all we've got. This is all we got. This is the closest thing to people that look like us. There was no Asian women on TV. And then years later, when Asian women did start to appear on TV, they were all in a certain role. Newsreaders, they were making documentaries, they were in serious roles, they were commentators. They weren't stand-up comedians. And I think you have to be slightly deluded in comedy. And I think that that's what men have over women. They're thick-skinned, they've got way more confidence. They die on stage and they'll deny it to themselves. They'll go, no, actually, I stormed it, I did really well.
Can I ask about those early TV jobs, with the people that employed you, so I guess kind of the people casting for panel shows or producers, directors, did you find them very welcoming? Were they like, oh my God, thank God you're here. We needed someone like you.
I don't think any direct casting director says that to any comic. Oh, thank God you're here. Oh my God, I've been waiting for you for 20 years.
Yeah.
Where have you been? I don't think any comic has heard that. The thing is, what happened is, when I started comedy, and 9/11 had happened shortly afterwards. And this often happens with people of colour in every profession, is that they're always looking for a spokesperson. Because as we all know, as a Muslim woman, I speak for all Muslim women in Britain.
Sure.
We all have the same opinion. Everybody, we're all on one big WhatsApp group. We all know what everybody's thinking, what everybody's saying, and what everybody's doing at any one time. Yeah. I mean, the number of times I've been mistaken for Nadia and Malala, it's ridiculous. We look nothing like each other. But obviously, we all know each other.
Oh, gosh.
But there was too much pressure on me to voice the community. If any event had happened that involved Muslims or brown people, all of a sudden, I'd be asked to go on a panel show and be funny about this.
The other thing that adds into that is that in that situation you're describing, for someone like you, there's also no invisibility. Like, if you're a white man in a group of six white men and you might have been doing stand-up for 6 months or a year, they can kind of hide while they get stronger and better and find out who they are and learn how to do those shows. Anyone who isn't a straight white man can sometimes feel so visible that it feels like you're literally thrown in the deep end with everyone waiting to go, are you going to be good? Because I presume not. Like, it's, and that's an added pressure.
When people talk about white privilege, I think that this is what it is, in a way, is that you have the privilege to be who you are. I remember doing a routine once about Primark, going into Primark and dropping my clothes on the floor and kicking shoes under the counter, and how I loved doing that, and I felt that it was like being in a jumble sale. But it was about my experience of going to Primark. And I remember this white male reviewer writing a review about me saying, what a waste of a good Muslim.
Oh.
What a waste of a Muslim woman's voice. There's so much she could have been talking about, and she decides to talk about Primark. And I just remember thinking, why do I have to do what you want me to do? The reason I became a comedian and turned my back on my religion and my culture, and nobody supported me, and I had death threats and hate mail. I went through all of this because I wanted to have my own voice. And I come into this industry, and now you are telling me what I should be talking about.
So, Shazia, has it changed, or is it the same now?
I think because I just carried on regardless and just thought, you know what, I want to do this. No amount of criticism or hatred or people trying to stop me doing this, I'm going to carry on. Thousands wouldn't have carried on. Well, we've seen this ourselves, not just people of colour, but women who just find this business so difficult, and they're great and they're funny, but they don't carry on. And I think because I love this so much and I felt, you know, I grew up in a very strict Muslim background. My life was planned out for me. I should have been married at 21. I should have carried on living in Birmingham and had a decent, respectable life. Because I turned my back on all of that and I found something that I loved, this comedy saved me from living a life that I didn't want to live. And I think it's really important for younger women and women that are coming into this business to see that it can be done.
Yeah, but also a voice. Like what you're describing now is the freedom to self-expression. And what you've put so beautifully is for some people, they take it for granted because it was always there for them, but you have fought for it. So hopefully other people will see and go, oh, I should be able to express myself. I might not want to be a comedian, but I can talk. I should be listened to. That in itself is such a, can be a huge thing if you're told to be quiet.
I think women are doing that now, more expressing their voice or saying what they think. Even though obviously women get more criticism than men, whatever we say, whatever, we only have to open our mouths and we will get criticism. But I think women are braver now because there's safety in numbers.
Blimey, what a hero.
What a hero. And it's really incredible because I had a very different experience to Shazia, partly because there were already women like her working in comedy who'd been working for a decade in comedy when I started, and also because I'm white. And so I would talk about my stuff about in terms of pressure or what women are supposed to talk about or surprise if there's a woman on the bill, but nothing to the extent. It's so clear she was destined to be a comedian, but her compulsion to be funny and to be looked at and the centre of attention kept her going while every direction was telling her there's a correct way to be you and that's not it. On top of that, when she says about how many women have quit, that makes me so sad because it's true. And some of the women who I've known who have stopped, it was almost because the world is a very harsh place and the work they were trying to do was sometimes too exquisite, too precious. And there is no safe space in comedy. You have to be so robust. And what's unfair about that is that we have lost voices.
Could you summarise what is still unfinished business for women in comedy and in this space?
What I would say is uniform is that anyone who's not being heard from, I know they might be fighting or jostling or pushing back like Shazia was describing, and actually Sandy did as well, in terms of at the very beginning at the comedy store where there's not even a toilet. You might have to jostle, but please don't think the world doesn't need to hear from you, because if we're not hearing from you already, we need you.
What you're saying to me is actually like the best of feminism. It's a feminism which is totally inclusive. It's not just about one type of woman. Mm. It's about women, trans women, men.
Yes.
Disabled women, you know, it's about changing the world, changing the structures, changing everything to include everything.
And there's always been a good thing in comedy, using the phrase, actually going back to what we're talking about, but keeping the door open. Like if there's a gig that only books men and you happen to be the first woman and you have a good gig and they start booking you, it's actually your responsibility to put a wedge under it and keep recommending other women, you know, who'd be great here and do this, that, because there can be a temptation sometimes, especially if one has had to work very, very hard to go, well, I made it, so it's possible. And the exact opposite needs to be true all of the time, going, it's not a zero-sum game. Wedge the door open for others after you.
Yeah, and hey, that's a win-win.
Yeah.
No one loses in that. That is a win-win.
I was listening to an interview the other day with a man who started Whole Foods, and it's actually a win-win-win. It's a win for you, a win for me, a win for everyone in society. We should always want it to be three wins.
Love it. So fantastic hearing from Sarah, Sandy and Shazia. And hearing how women won't be silenced, can't be silenced, should never be silenced, which is exactly what we explore in the exhibition at the British Library. I don't know about you, but I have loved this episode. This has been Unfinished Business, a PixU production for the British Library. Thanks to Sarah Pascoe, Sandy Toksvig and Shazia Mirza. And of course, Mouse the Dog. I'll leave you now with a word about the Unfinished Business exhibition from an acclaimed writer.
I think the exhibition is so exciting and I'm thrilled to have even had anything to do with it. And I'd have to say that I've written 12 books in the library, at the British Library.
Oh, because you're an author.
Because I'm an author. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sandy.
It's just so brilliant to have you, author Sandy, here with us. It's how we will refer to you. Prolific author Sandy Toksvig, you may have heard of, from her books.